This is Comics Therapy, episode 45. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from June 4th, 2014. Dave number 5 and The Woods number 2. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we talk with writer Jeremy Holt. As a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Hey, this is John Cole, J_Cole on Twitter. The question about favorite alien in a movie, books, etc. Obviously, Superman. Most helpful, most powerful, least destructive. Aliens aren't always good news for us, but this is one alien invasion that pays off in spades. Definitely go Superman.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. You know how this works. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything that we say seriously. This week we're talking about the classic threat that has peppered speculative fiction for centuries, alien invasion. It's a theme that we've touched on before, but like I said, so has virtually every other civilization since the dawn of time. There are literally infinite alien civilizations to discuss, but we try to keep the show to around an hour and a half. So today we're talking about Earth under attack long after the demise of humans, leaving our successors to defend their lives and our legacy, and we're taking a look at what might happen when the aliens themselves have home field advantage, and your only defense is a field hockey stick and some theater props. Also, that totally makes the humans the aliens, right? Psh, mind blown.
Whoa.
Right?
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating what we love, for the most part, about comics. This week we ask for your favorite aliens from any media. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
Greetings, Aaron and Andrea, faithful protectors of false Twitter charities on the internet. This is the man that can't be stopped, Roderick Ruth here, at Roderick Ruth on Twitter. And my answer, a favorite alien has to be Sally Solomon from NBC's sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. Aw, hell, I'll give it to Dick, Tom, and Harry, too. This ensemble cast of alien explorers inside of human bodies had some of the best exposition on physiology, society, archetypes, gender roles, and rituals. You name it, they made fun of it and did it extremely well. Not to mention, it's where a young star named Joseph Gordon-Levitt started his ascension to Hollywood. Easy, ladies. And since it's comics therapy, favorite comic alien will go to the alien symbiote of Spider-Man lore. Aside from the weakness to sound and fire, this symbiote has been a comic book inker's wet dream and nightmare. Who knew that what started out as a costume change for Webhead in Secret Wars would eventually get passed around like a hot potato to a bunch of other characters in the Marvel Universe, eventually spawning a slew of archenemies for old Spidey, and then finally ending up on his paraplegic friend slash former high school bully, Flash Thompson. That's all I got. Until next time, thanks guys.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. So, Aaron, how was your week? Anything you want to talk about?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. It's been a pretty dull time around here.
This week? Sure.
Yep.
Oh, I bought a lot of comics.
This is not new. You tell me that every single week.
It's still exciting.
I still don't pay attention.
May have come across a dead body.
What?
Our morning walk spot.
Wow.
It's the deputies had just shown up and they made us leave, so all I saw was the body tarp out. But I haven't been able to find anything in the paper about it, but I haven't looked today either, so.
So it was like a secret dead body.
I don't even think they were sheriffs.
Maybe it was an alien dead body.
Could be. That actually would make a lot more sense.
You're so committed to our theme that it's infiltrating your regular life.
That is true. I do everything for the show.
You do. That was never so clear as it was this past week. My answer, I didn't think about it. Why would I think about it?
Do you want to know my answer?
Not particularly. I will say that when we discussed this, I thought that we were talking specifically, exclusively about comics. And so I had been originally considering various alien races, like big bad guys from Marvel comics and, like, you know, other instances where aliens were less of a, you know, focused protagonist and more of a, like, threat in the distance. And then when you actually posted it and made it more of a friendly alien kind of favorite of all media focus. Too many choices. I just can't narrow it down.
Well, okay. I guess you don't have to answer it at all.
Nope.
I mean, all right. So does that mean I don't have to answer?
No. You offered to, so.
Oh, I mean, yeah, you could, there's a million different things that are great and awesome, but if I like think, I always go with whatever comes to mind first at the time it's asked.
You do, and sometimes those are stupid. So what was it this time?
It was the movie Enemy Mine.
Oh.
From like 1986, I'm going to say.
Not on my radar.
With Louis Gossett Jr. playing the alien.
Okay.
And it's about, and this is, sorry guys, spoilers. So there's like this, it's like humans and this alien race, I forget exactly why, but they're, you know, space, they're at war with each other, and two pilots crash land on this planet, one of the alien race and one human, and they're stranded there, and they can't get emergency signals out or anything, and they learn to have to use, you know, like rely on each other to survive.
Right.
And then the alien dies in childbirth because they're hermaphroditic.
Okay.
And then the human raises the child on the planet.
Aww. That's adorable. Yeah. And what lesson did we all learn?
That lizard people that you fight in interspace battles can give birth and leave you with their kids to take care of.
God, deadbeat dad lizard people. That sucks.
Or mom.
Sure. Got it.
Deadbeat people.
Let's be
politically correct here.
It's not a people. It's an alien.
Persons.
Deadbeat aliens. That's the point.
Wow, you are very xenophobic.
I am. You're right. Can Q be my answer?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about it in advance, but man, I really enjoyed him and the zaniness he brought to Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Q's great. I mean, if you just even focused on Star Trek, there's a million things.
Totally.
I mean, the Borg are awesome.
They are. I didn't appreciate them until when I was older. I mean, I watched that when it was on when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's my Star Trek, right? But there are
Are you talking Next Generation or Voyager?
No, I'm talking Next Generation.
Okay.
But there's a lot more about it that I appreciated when I was older. Obviously, not necessarily because of plot sophistication or things like that, but just like references within science fiction and like larger sort of tropes and things like that. And that the idea of an assimilation culture, I thought was cooler later than I.
Yeah, man.
Right.
You know, it's like awesome. The Borg is just like what happens to you when you're
totally
like an adult.
Rad.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All that stuff. But no, I thought Q was cool because he was still not a nice guy, but
he was like the Loki of Star Trek.
Yeah, I accept that. That's a pretty good analogy. And
he was the mischief maker.
Sure, and obviously that's a character type that I typically enjoy. So no surprises there. I
do like mischief makers.
I'm very consistent. Anything else going on with you? I'm at the theater like right now, right at this minute.
We can tell from the terrible audio quality.
I hope not. I hope because I really went to bat for the fact that it was going to work for me to record from here. And so if it sounds like shit, I'll never do it again. But if it actually sounds okay, then same bat time, same bat channel.
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll just make this show free for everyone.
Ah, that's so generous.
Yeah, we'll just give it away this week because the audio quality isn't quite as, you know, it's not up to par.
The very model of a modern major general.
I am magnanimous beyond all.
Hurry up, come up with another M word.
Yeah, I was trying to think of beyond all magnitude.
Right, well done.
Kind of. That's magnanimous and magnitude? Not very good.
No. I retract my praise.
Let's just talk about some comics.
Okay.
My favorite movie alien is Alien from Spring Breakers, played by James Franco. Because it's the best fucking movie that ever was made, period. And you should back Toe Tag Riot, hit up toetagriot.com or godhateszombies.com and back it today. Thanks, Iron. Rom's a robot, he sucks, bye.
Our first book this week is Dave number 5, Dave with a 4 instead of an A.
They know that.
Do they?
I think so.
No, they do now. Written and lettered by Ryan Ferrier, with art by Valentine Ramon. Dave with a 4 is published by Monkey Brain Comics.
Hey, guess what? I wrote summaries this week.
Oh, good job.
I know. So, here's Dave. Robot uprising, defeated human race, except they followed our lead too much, and they basically recreated all the worst parts of our society. Dead-end jobs, empty relationships, it's pretty bleak. Like, think Office Space. There's plenty of deliberate references. Meets, I don't know, something with robots, like ROM, maybe.
How dare you?
I love you, Aaron Myers. Anyway, our hero, Dave, is a former defense robot whose role was made obsolete after they conquered the galaxy. So now his life, or whatever life is when you're a robot, totally sucks. Until a new alien race invades. And this is the fifth and final book in the miniseries about what Dave does after the aliens come to Earth.
Ta-da-da.
Yeah. I thought that this series started really, really, really strong and went out a bit less strong.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, there's so much about the concept of alien invasion as opportunity that I think is pretty nifty that we didn't, it just wasn't the focus. We didn't get to see as much about the, like, rebuilding. Everything seems to be fine in a jokey kind of way, but things were so shitty for so many of, like, Dave and his robot pals at the beginning in terms of the way that their society was organized that brought to the brink of destruction and then having to rebuild from scratch seemed like, thanks, aliens, thanks for helping us out. But there's not as much about the rebuilding. We see Dave is in a better place than he was before, and that's cool, but...
Yeah, but that's the prologue, or the epilogue. I mean, who cares about that stuff? To me, it's like, I like that it is satirizing human culture by, you know, putting it in that, okay, fine, you know, what would be a human story, they're robots.
Right.
That's the funny aspect of it.
Sure, certainly.
I like that, though, it's exemplifying how humanity really only thrives under adversity. Otherwise, we become complacent, miserable, fat, you know, drones.
Like Wall-E style.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we need that. We need the alien invasions to come together as a people and overcome.
Light the fire under your ass and get up off the couch so you can go beat the aliens.
Right. Like Starship Troopers. You know, oh, there's boy. Aspects of that.
Sure. Okay.
You know, humanity comes together because we got to beat the bugs.
Maybe with, like, slightly less overt socialism.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, nothing wrong with socialism.
Occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, light socialism. Thanks a lot, Obama.
I think that the satire of the, like, the societal satire is the strongest part of Dave. And I think that maybe that's why I wanted to see more about, like, the other side of the mirror. Because we spend so much time with Dave and how shitty his job situation is and how his home life is a total mess and all of the statements made about how he's trapped and he only has his memories of his glory days to kind of live through. And so when he has success at the end, like after the alien invasion and after his role in stopping it, I don't know, it was slightly emptier success for me because we actually don't see him as a winner. We see him after he's already achieved that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
So we spend a lot of time with Dave the loser, and then we see him kick ass, but...
Yeah, it's a redemption story.
I suppose, but I don't know. There's a piece of that redemption where it's acknowledged externally that we don't actually get to share in. Because we jump ahead. After the aliens are conquered, we jump ahead to the changes that have been made. We don't see them. We don't see the immediate aftermath, I guess. Just an observation.
Sure, but this is, you know, this is the first mini.
Is there...
There could be more. There could be.
It's a fun concept in terms of the Earth's inherited by the robots in a very much less destructive way than, say, I don't know, other robot uprisings. You know, this isn't the Matrix. This is
sure. Yes.
This is us as robots. Got it? Haha. And that's that. I think that level of humor is, I appreciate that.
I'm glad you appreciate it. I liked it, and I like the way that it ended, because I don't need to see the post. You either end on a high note, or you start a second arc.
Okay.
And, you know, it's like
Myers,
you know,
we're totally reviewing this. I need to shut up. Yeah, I don't mean like to make it be like that. I think that it's hard for me to... I'm going to shut up, because that's exactly what I'm doing. Let's talk about aliens.
Finally. God. Because, yeah, I mean, you could pick apart the story all you want. I don't know. For 5 issues, I enjoyed every one. They're funny, and I like the concepts, and it makes me, you know, think about what it is to be human, and maybe it is human's legacy to just to build ourselves, you know, into metal bodies, essentially.
Right.
And the soul of humanity is strife and, you know, adversity.
I had this moment I think the first time that we actually see the aliens outside of Earth, where I was wondering if maybe they were more benevolent than they ended up being. That they were going to, like, usurp this, like, conquering power from Earth and restore it to, I don't know, something closer to what it was when the humans lived there. That's not at all what happens.
No.
They're evil, bad aliens, and they're super gross. But, and
are they?
Yes.
Okay,
yes, they are clearly the bad guys.
Well, hang on, though. So, look at this from a different perspective. Humanity reaches out to the stars. We come across a planet entirely controlled by machines of a formerly, you know, populated planet of biological beings,
mm-hmm,
that has precious resources that we need to expand our empire.
Mm-hmm.
What does humanity do?
I don't know.
We nuke the hell out of it, take everything we need, strip mine it, and blow it up.
Yeah.
So
I've seen that movie.
I wouldn't say the aliens are evil.
Book.
It's just it's self-preservation of species.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think that's what I was considering. The motives. Huh. You're right. You're framing the motives from the perspective of the humans as aliens. But
yeah, I would take it even further. I'd say we come across a planet. If we're expanding like a galactic empire, we're pushing out into the rest of the universe. It's every species for themselves. You know, any kind of competition of resources will result in a war, and the victor goes the spoils.
Okay.
You know, because we're stuck on this orb altogether, we do it amongst ourselves.
Right.
But once we can get off this godforsaken rock and move out into the rest of the universe, we'll do it to other, you know, species.
Do you think that's actually going to happen? I mean, realistically, do you think that is in the cards for humanity as we understand it?
Yes, it is in. Yes, we will definitely. What is left of humanity will make it off of Earth.
You put a disclaimer in there.
Well, people are still going to be around. We're cockroaches.
Okay.
So, you know, we'll continue to evolve. I think it's going to be hundreds of years before, like, we really can get outside of our solar system.
I think that's optimistic, but I'm not a scientist.
Hang on. One of your degrees isn't in astrophysics?
Oh, please, can we not do this again?
Okay, fine.
But my brother is a rocket scientist.
No, yes. That's true. See, he'll be one of the people to make it off of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
He will be he'll cryogenically freeze himself.
I don't think that's a thing.
No. Can he transfer himself, his consciousness, into a robot body?
Also not a thing yet.
That's
a thing about the robots in Dave that I do want to point out, that was not the implication. There was no human consciousness transferred into robot bodies. It's like, fuck humans. The humans had their chance and they totally lost. This is strictly...
Which is hilarious, though, because, like, humanity is a virus. Like, you know,
yeah,
the robots are infected with humanity.
Oh, it's a super fun premise. Mm-hmm. I agree. I just got hung up in the resolution, like I always do.
Great. Well, why don't you break it down for us some more?
How long have we been doing this, Myers? Come on. That's, like, my biggest downfall.
This is your biggest downfall?
Yeah, I think so. Why? Do you have a better idea? Like, what?
Well, hang on. Look. The list is across the room. I'll tell you next time.
Should we talk about another comic instead?
Yeah, let's talk about children getting killed. That's even more fun.
Than all of the human race? Like, we're specific.
Well, you know, then robot uprising.
Oh, got it. Sure.
Yeah, I mean specifically.
Right.
My favorite alien is David Bowie in Nick Rogue's The Man Who Fell to Earth. Whoops! And now I have to turn off my daughter's toy because I'm on the phone. Okay, Lorelai, who's your favorite alien?
Who's your favorite alien?
Him, you, and Daddy, and Robbie.
Okay, my daughter's favorite alien is our family. So there are things we should probably confess, but no. Anyway, David Bowie, Man Who Fell to Earth. Hang on. There.
Door.
This is what happens when you try to call in a three-year-old. My favorite alien, David Bowie, Nick Rogue's Man Who Fell to Earth, just for so many reasons. Hot, scary, very real in a weird 70s way. That's all. Bye.
Our second book is The Woods, number 2, written by James Tinian IV, with art by Michael Dialinus.
Nope. Change again.
Nope. Dialinus.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. Colors are by Josan Gonzalez, and lettering is by Ed Dukeshire.
When I said good, by the way, that's not because I was sanctioning your pronunciation. You just at least read it with the correct consonants in the correct order.
Yeah, yeah. You know, letters and order and stuff. Right. I mean, I got all the letters the first time. They just weren't the right, you know.
Exactly.
All right. The Woods is published by Boom Comics.
So we've got high school kids with high school problems, just like our show last week, until their entire school is transported to an unknown alien world, like our show this week. See, comics are really great because they work on so many levels, you guys. Anyway, we have a nicely rounded out cast of teenagers battling both teacher and alien to figure out where the hell they are and how they're going to survive. Some of the students have left the school, interpreting an ancient beacon as a sign that their survival depends on venturing into the woods.
Another dun-dun-dun.
Yeah, well, I think that that's what you get with aliens. Because of the unknown, right? Like, mm-hmm. You don't actually have any basis to trust aliens to be good guys or bad guys, because they are, in fact, alien. So you don't have a frame of reference.
That is true. This is like one part The Mist and one part Aliens, like, and one part Murder World.
I don't know if I think that it's Murder World.
Kind of.
Okay.
All these kids get transported to a world that they have to fight to survive on.
But they're not fighting each other. Yet?
Well, not yet.
I did think of a couple of things that it reminded me of, but then I forgot, so it's not relevant.
Well, that's my explanation of it. I like these ideas where it's the who will step up. Who are the problem solvers and who are the panickers?
Sure, sure.
And it seems often in stories like this, the adults become the panickers.
Yeah.
And there's a group of kids that have the level-headedness.
Election. That's what it reminded me of.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
Because we've got, like, the smart-ass student council president who knows everything but actually doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think, man... Here I am about to tell you again that you're actually right.
Yeah.
I am way on
point this week.
I know. Man. There is an aspect of Murder World going on here because of the home field advantage that the aliens have. Like the smack down in the middle of their world, this school gets placed. And mm-hmm. there's an indication that they're kind of watching what's happening.
Right.
Not a subtle indication. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. I think that's really interesting that they are not so passive as an alien race as to watch the Earth. They've actually like taken a little corner of Earth and brought it to their or to a different world. But now they're going to sit back and kind of see what happens. And I don't know.
Maybe.
Well, at least right now, there's not an active interaction.
I do like those Independence Day was such a popular movie
because
it was funny. It was like semi tongue in cheek, and you know, obviously the special effects for the time were mind blowing. But mm-hmm. it was also people coming together to, you know, it's that other thing. It's like we have the other is out there. It's attacking us. Let's come together as people and overcome it.
Yeah, I wrote that down on the script because I wanted to remember to mention the speech, and then damn it, I can't even remember when I have it in front of me to mention shit. That's how I'm really tired this week, man.
I am like sharp as a tack and you are as flat as a shoe.
And no one has ever called me flat, so don't worry about that. But I am definitely not on my game. I am tired. I've been really busy, so I apologize.
Well, we should record a show that's supposed to entertain people.
I know. I was all proud of myself because I wrote summaries, and it turns out I should have paid more attention to, I don't know, anything else.
You snorted a line of Adderall or something?
Absolutely. Anyway, what was I saying?
Right. What was I saying? I was saying I like these kind of books. Not so much because it's teenagers, but because there is the group that sees the moment and doesn't become paralyzed by fear to explore the dangerous unknown.
Whereas I like these kinds of books because that's all fine. But I like this like omniscient power role. I think that is a...
You like the puppet master?
A little bit. I think that's an intriguing... I think that's an intriguing device in storytelling, which is interesting because I almost always dislike dramatic irony when it's used as like a way of revealing things about characters. But when there is a more puppet master kind of structure, like in Cabin in the Woods, I think that's super fun. Most of the time. I'm trying to think if there's any exceptions that come to mind, but no, because it's not yet anything other than just passive observation within a high stress environment.
So are you a big fan of The Hunger Games?
I have never read The Hunger Games, nor have I seen the movies.
Well, there's a very similar aspect to that, you know, there. Children pitted against each other, but in a murder world scenario.
Yeah, I've been told that I would probably like it. For a while, I shied away from it because I was like not into this sort of dystopian fiction with kids dying shit like in The Giver, which is probably my least favorite book ever, and I know that we've talked about that
before.
What?
Are you kidding me?
I hate it.
No, we've never talked about that.
Oh, God, I fucking hate it. I hate it so much, and it's entirely based on the fact that I read it when Avi was about a year old.
Oh,
I didn't read
okay.
it when I was younger.
Okay.
So I am incapable of separating that. You know, I've worked really hard this past year to stop projecting, and I think that is one piece of fiction that I will be unable to not project on, or whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. But you recently read I Kill Giants.
Yeah. I don't know why you keep bringing that up as some sort of example of my ability to separate myself emotionally from a book. I cried for hours after that.
Right, but you don't hate it. You loved it.
I loved it, but it... Man, stop making me think. I loved that because the message was one of hope and strength, and yeah, because Barbara is stronger than she thinks she is, and that is such an important message to take away from adversity in life. What's the message in The Giver?
Yeah, okay, fine. It's depressing.
Yeah, it's depressing as hell.
But
it's overwhelming. It's the kind of thing that makes me want to scream that's what we are capable of as humans.
What's the Stephen King book with the kids who run like it's not the Running Man. It's like, you know, they get chosen to do this trek, you know, it's like mm-hmm. whatever 10,000 mile or across the country.
I don't know.
You know, and if they stop, they die.
Nothing that you have described sounds familiar to me.
Oh, people will know, and I cannot remember the name of it. But but it deals with teenagers, and it's sort of like a precursor, I would say, to Hunger Games in that way.
Mm.
And I read that at the age those kids are, and it's not I hate it or anything like that. It's just when you feel so too closely connected,
mm-hmm.
especially because the writing is so good that you get immersed in the story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure
that I can make all of those statements about The Giver. I think that I think the story, like the emotional core of the story just hit home with where I was in my life at that time. I don't want to reread it to try to figure out if it has that like longevity of impact.
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't put it in the same category for me as I Kill Giants, because I Kill Giants was an incredibly powerful experience that was very emotional, but ultimately it was art. Like it's a stunning portrayal of that very like cathartic journey that Barbara goes through, accepting, I don't want to spoil it, because like honestly it's one of those few books that you just have to read. So like, mm-hmm. guys, if you haven't read it yet, just go read it, but bring a box of Kleenex with you and it's amazing. But The Giver doesn't end with this testament to strength in the same kind of way. It sure. ends on a slightly up note compared to what they go through to survive, but like part of my issue, like I said earlier, is that the resolution isn't resolved.
So what's your feeling of 1984?
I appreciate it.
But is it the same sort of thing? Because like in 1984, it ends with him being fully broken by the system, and only in that moment is he allowed to die with a bullet to the head.
Right, but man, I don't know. I read 1984 first when I was in high school, and then I read it again when I was in my 20s. I think that I can separate myself from that in a way that I may not ever be willing to do. I shouldn't say that I couldn't do it with The Giver. It's that I'm not willing to. Like, it's just not worth it for me to even try. That sounds like such a jerky thing.
No, that's fair. That's fine. I'm sure if I thought about it and dug through stuff, there's probably books like that for me too.
Yeah.
Nothing comes to mind right now, but I also tend to gravitate to dystopian literature.
I have gotten much more interested in that over the past year, and I think that I have learned to appreciate it more. So whereas I used to say that I just like flat out don't like dystopian fiction, I don't like post-apocalyptic stories, it turns out that I like them quite a bit, but there are certain elements that I appreciate more. And I mean, I even got to the point with The Walking Dead that where the themes that are sort of being touched on, like so totally separately from the zombies, the reestablishment of society is interesting. Like building again in a new and better way, I am fascinated by. Because once that paradigm shift occurs, you have all of this opportunity, and we can't actually fathom the change because we've not experienced it. And so in fiction, we have this opportunity to write about after the aliens have left and we won. And what would be different? Like, how would you actually restart society with this now knowledge that there's, you know, definitively bigger shit out there? Or whatever it is, like, we almost blew ourselves up, but we didn't. Or we didn't die by the zombies. Like, whatever it is that we've overcome, that's going to change everything. And so I think that that is really, really interesting. But that's not what's happening in The Giver. The Giver is still, like, locked in this, like, horribly depressing world that we created for ourselves, and everything is terrible. And God, I hate that book.
You know, we started out talking about The Woods.
Right, which I enjoyed.
Oh, good.
Yep. I thought I was pretty clear that I thought that there was there's some good stuff happening in that story.
Yeah. It's just, look how far we've come. in a few short minutes.
Well, we always do that. We get super off track. That's like, you've never listened to the show before, Aaron.
I would not listen to the show.
I barely listen to it. When I edit, sometimes it's painful.
Yes. But speaking of not being painful, we have a great interview.
We did.
With Jeremy Holt.
Yep. Another Monkey Brain writer. And really great insight about his process becoming a published writer. Mm-hmm. And some conversation about both past comics that he has, like an announcement about one specifically that's moving publishers, and then discussion about his current series with Monkey Brain. So, good stuff.
Yeah, and you know, life and creation and comic books and comic
shops. No aliens, though. Like, total missed opportunity to get him to weigh in on what aliens are cool.
Well, if we did a good show, we would have. But yeah. You know what? We already said, this week's free.
We're just, like, such givers.
We sure are.
The giver, because...
Right, obviously. People hate that. Yep. All right, let's talk to Jeremy Holt.
Cool.
Hi, guys. Jason Sachs here at Jason Sachs on the Twitter. Last week, my call was very long. This week, my call will be very short. You know in your heart there can only be one choice for the best alien ever. That's Superman, the man from Krypton and the symbol of America. We love him. He's Superman. He's amazing. Who cares if some of his comics suck? He's still one of the greatest heroes of all time. Thanks, guys. Catch you later. Bye.
This week on The Couch, we welcome writer Jeremy Holt. You may know him from his Multiversity column, Strange Love, or his books, Southern Dog and Cobble Hill, both published by 215 Inc. He is currently writing two books published by Monkey Brain Comics, Art Monster and Skinned, the latter co-written by Tim Daniel. Thanks for talking with us today, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me. This is a big thrill. I just got into your guys' podcast recently, so it's pretty cool that we were able to link this up.
Oh, it's wonderful timing.
Well, let's start with a status update on Art Monster and Skinned, and then anything else that you have in the works that you want to tell us about.
Sure. Art Monster and Skinned are both still in production. Let's see. Two issues of Art Monster are currently out. Skin's second issue is available for pre-order on the 18th of this month.
Okay. Meaning June, because it's June.
Yeah, it's June 1st.
Right.
I have to remind myself of that. And let's see. Cobble Hill is kind of on an indefinite hold. Okay. Southern Dog actually recently moved publishers. It will be coming out through Action Lab Entertainment in August.
Right, I saw that. So is that, what, can you explain a little bit more about what that means, shifting from 215 Inc. to Action Lab? And Action Lab Entertainment is their more adult-focused line, yes? No?
Yes, so it would be going through Action Lab Danger Zone, which is more mature content imprint. It's pretty simple. When I signed up with 215 a couple years ago, they were very upfront and said, look, we don't really have the money for printing books, but once you get the series done, we would print the trade, but you're more than welcome to shop it elsewhere if you get a better offer. Mm. It's like, okay, that seems fair enough. And when Southern Dog and Cobble Hill debuted in 2012, I want to say, those books, you know, were really well received, and because of that, the artists suddenly got more work elsewhere. So both of those projects basically came to a grinding halt, and it was kind of a big learning lesson for me. But when I decided to try to revive Southern Dog, I sent it over to Action Lab, and they were very excited about it, and they were willing to print the book, and that was enough to get the band back together. So we knocked it out and finished the 4-issue miniseries, and yeah, so it's available for pre-order now, and the first issue debuts in August.
And it will come out with the same creative team and come out in issues as opposed to trade?
Yes, so it'll come out in single issues. I believe it's actually Action Lab Danger Zone's first monthly series because...
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, Danger Zone mostly does bi-monthly, and because of Riley Rossmo's covers and because the book was completely done, I was able to convince them to maybe do it monthly because it is a small press book and it would be easier for retailers to jump on board.
Mm. Right.
And the creative team is intact with the exception of Ed Brisson. Ed Brisson lettered the first issue.
He's
a little busy. He's kind of making a name for himself. So I was able to get Adam Wallet, a good friend of mine who's basically lettered all of my work. He jumped on and he finished up the last three issues.
Excellent.
So let me ask you real quick, what was the lesson learned in that double-edged sword of success of getting attention for a very small, you know, press, small folk, you know, small audience book, but then it gets this notoriety, which then tends to draw away the creative teams to other projects?
I think I was really excited to just get a book out to kind of have an announcement, and I didn't really think about the production in a kind of full perspective. And I should have really tried to get most of the books done before announcing them, but you know, that can be hard on a creative team that, you know, maybe there isn't any upfront money involved, so everybody's working on spec and so that was kind of the learning curve, was that, you know, I should have maybe tried to wait and had more in the bag before I announced. I feel lucky that the team was able to come back together and was interested in finishing out the book, because that Southern Dog had been fully scripted, I'd say maybe three and a half years ago. So it was like, it's been done for a very long time and I've just been sitting on it. It was cool to get the team back on. And I think, you know, they were excited about the fact that it would be coming out monthly and that Action Lab, you know, has the, I guess the clout now that, you know, when they say they're going to print a book, they're going to do it. And, you know, their catalog is growing and I think they're coming out with some really great stuff. So, it kind of just was really good timing.
Yeah. Overall. They've really expanded their catalog and they've gotten a lot more attention over the last few years too. It seems like that company is really growing as a publisher.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's take a step back, and talk about your column, Strange Love. So it was subtitled How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Breaking into Comic Books. And we've talked to a lot of younger creators about the process of going from, you know, that wanting to create to actually creating. And we've heard some, you know, some really excellent advice. Is there anything you can point out as being the definitive moment or event or advice that you got that helped you drop the anxiety and focus on creating?
That's a great question. I think it was just a unique life experience I was going through at the time. in the column, I do mention that I basically was broke at a certain point in my life where I was working a day job. I was making enough money to pay rent just barely, but I wasn't doing anything creative. I had gone to art school. That, you know, I graduated, I got a degree, but I didn't really use it and I wasn't interested in using it. And I fell into fixing computers full time and I thought, hey, this feels more like, you know, a reflex. Maybe I should focus on this as a career. And I did that for several years and I was fixing Apple computers. And after a while, I was just like, you know, this isn't satisfying. Like, I can do it and I feel proud of what I've accomplished getting certified and going through all that. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't fulfilling. So at one point, my bank account was in the negative numbers. My credit card was maxed out. I think I had a bag of cashews to last me about 5 days. And I was, you know, thinking a lot about you know, how I got myself there. And, you know, I've always...
It's a very, like, Kafka or Dostoevsky kind of scene, modern day scene.
Yeah, maybe. And I think I've always liked telling stories, and I never really thought about it seriously. I wrote short stories in high school and whatnot, but I didn't take it seriously. And I was thinking a lot about the stock market crash of 2008, and I was thinking about if I was to tell a story around that, you know, how would I do it? And the original concept was, I believe, as a zombie comic, which, you know, everybody, I think their first comic is a zombie comic. And I think with some research and some time, I was able to develop it. And I just, you know, honestly, even though my day job was sucking most of my time, I was meeting a lot of interesting people. And I was really kind of getting involved in going to comic book shops and, like, getting to know the owners. And there's a shop in Brooklyn that I used to go to all the time, Bergen Street Comics, and the owners mm-hmm. there, Tom and Amy, were instrumental in just getting me into the industry and, like, meeting creators. And it was some of those experiences and reading a lot of comics at the time that I just decided I was going to start writing. I think it was after I read Why the Last Man, or I was, I think, halfway through the series, I just decided I was going to write. And because I had, you know, no real distractions, because I couldn't go out and hang out with friends and have a beer or something, I just stayed in for, I'd say, maybe 6 weeks, and I just wrote this story involving the stock market crash and it being a kind of a socioeconomic story. And yeah, it was absolute garbage what I turned out. But I wrote about 150 pages. I got it out, and I spent a lot of time editing it and passing it around with friends and just trying to get a sense of where I existed in this world of comics if I had a shot. And, you know, I was able to make some really interesting connections through that. And that's how it started.
Is that, in my impression, I've never been there, but Bergen Street Comics seems very indie focused. You know, it seems yes. to be kind of the New York equivalent of the Portland scene in a lot of ways.
I think so.
And it seems like that would be a good kind of epicenter for meeting other, you know, small publisher creators, people who are kind of working in alternative or independent media. I guess aside from that, the question would be, what was your comics evolution too? Like, what was the history of your you know, growing up with comics, or was there, or, you know, when did they click for you, both at creating, you know, you wanted to create them, but in reading them as well?
I was always aware of them. I think I was more aware of the X-Men cartoons. I mean, my oldest brother is probably the most influential person in all of this. He collected comics as a kid. I read some of those, but I wasn't really into it. Like, you know, I kind of liked some of the characters, like, you know, for some reason I was really drawn towards Wolverine and Jubilee, their relationship. And but from there, I didn't really think much of it. And then I went maybe 12 years without even talking about or reading a comic. And it wasn't until maybe 5.5 years ago, I was hanging out with the same older brother, and his wife took the kids for the day, and he was like, "Hey, do you want to just go to a coffee shop and read some old comics?" And I was like, "Sure." And he gave me Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. And that book opened my eyes to how real comic stories could be. How, you know, how involved the characterization can get, and how it can make a very well-known character more interesting. And from there, I just started reading. So, I mean, my comics education is only about half a decade old, maybe, like, really spending a lot of time reading comics. So in a way, I've been kind of playing catch up, but I've also kind of focused on just reading creator-owned comics. Like, I haven't really gotten back into the big two.
So I want to talk about Southern Dog specifically, because sure. because you've mentioned in other interviews about your experiences as a young Asian American living in the Deep South and the racism that you experienced firsthand. And I've also seen that you mentioned a dream that you had with werewolves fighting the Klansmen. I'm curious, though, about the decision as a writer to take your personal experiences, which are obviously emotionally charged and a very relevant touchstone for readers, and then combining them with the very fantastical world of werewolves, because it's obviously a very different decision from writing, for example, an autobio story about the time that you spent living in Texas.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the story Southern Dog was, it was born out of that vivid dream I had, but I didn't really do anything with it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought the imagery was kind of interesting. And what I've learned a lot about just writing in general is that I wanted to kind of really think about the experiences I've gone through. I think one of the most interesting panels I went to early on was at New York Comic Con, and Nick Spencer was being asked about some stuff, and he told this story where, you know, he had pitched a comic and he got a comic together and he went to a convention and he was pitching it to some editors, and, you know, he wrote this like romance comic and the editor flipped through it and he's just like, what do you know about love? Like, you're what, how old? You're 23. Like, go live life and then come back to me. And he did that. He went off and had a career in politics and he did a bunch of stuff for like 5 or 6 years. And then he decided he was going to start writing stories. And, you know, I had lived a lot before I was 18. I'd spent most of my life living overseas, and I've experienced a lot that most people haven't. And I thought that I was at a unique advantage. And more specifically with Southern Dog, I was in a relationship a while ago where this girl's father or her family owned a lot of property out in Pearland, Texas. And one of their family friends is Ted Nugent. And Ted Nugent would go to their family farm and hunt and make these hunting videos. And she made me watch some of them. And
oh my God.
It was really bizarre because there was a level of respect I had in the sense that he really treated hunting like a religion. Like you respected the animal. You only killed what you had to, even though, I mean, this was, you know, hunting around and the animals were there to be hunted. But you know, that stuck with me because it was just very unique. And then I thought, hey, you know, why not merge those two ideas of putting a werewolf in a culture where hunting is a religion? Like, that mm-hmm. seems a no-brainer. And that's kind of where it evolved. And I started doing some research into the Klan, and I learned a lot about the three major movements they've gone through and how they've evolved today. And I, you know, wanted to try to tell kind of a side story to just a coming of age story of, you know, what the Klan is now and, you know, what their, you know, what their belief structures are and stuff like that, to kind of like ground it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was, as a side note outside of that, you know, with, in terms of hunting, I've always found it very, I have a lot of respect for hunters who live hunting as like that religion, you know, who have reverence for the hunt and the kill. And I could definitely say that about Ted Nugent. You know, politically, we might say one thing or another, but
sure.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. It's that having respect for, not in terms of sport, but in terms of the act itself. It's so primal in a way, and it really that plays back into Southern Dog too, because there's a lot of primal instincts and culturally primal things that get brought up in a story like that. That you can really tap into.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, drawing from some of my life experiences and some of the really interesting, I guess, factoids that I came across as far as the Klan, you know, I just, to me, the story kind of leapt off the page in my mind and I just started writing it. And it was one of the easier stories to write.
That's always a good thing to hear afterwards, that it was kind of a natural process after you'd had all of the pieces in play, they came together relatively painlessly.
Yeah.
what I always find fascinating, especially with stories kind of based, like rooted in very personal experience, is keeping that sort of unbiased, you know, reporting, storytelling aspect of it. Because, you know, especially when it comes to racism and you know, the treating of the other and marginalizing and that sort of thing, they're very emotionally charged. And if you had personal experience with it too, it seems like it takes a lot of self-control not to use it as a cathartic kind of expulsion, you know, in terms of writing.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want it to be this one-sided, like, the Klan's bad, let's just get that out in the open and let's just show how bad they are.
Right.
you know, it's, I think that would have been a ridiculously easy story to tell. And I think it would have been very one-dimensional. And you know, my experiences with racism have, I've experienced some like intense moments where, you know, there was aggression and possible violence, but, you know, it wasn't anything like these grand, like cross burnings or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's more subtle things that I think are, can be more dangerous and more potent, honestly. Mm-hmm. Especially when it's so subtle that sometimes I didn't detect it immediately. And, so I wanted to kind of explore that a bit. And growing up overseas, it's like my family, I was raised Catholic, and it's a very unique way to grow up. And, you know, when you live overseas, not everybody is Catholic, and not even your neighbor might not even be Catholic. They might not even speak English. So, you know, growing up where the culture in my household contrasted the culture I was living in was, you know, a very unique experience. And, you know, that's something I wanted to bring to the story of Southern Dog, where there's this kid who, he has his own moral compass, and it's completely going against everything he's experiencing at school, even in his own house, and it's him trying to navigate through that. And, you know, a lot of things he kind of, you know, his decisions, honestly, I probably would not have been as confident and strong as he is in this story. Like, I just know myself well enough that if I was in that situation, I would have just flown under the radar, try to just avoid everything and just try to, you know, get along with everybody. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wanted to write a character that, you know, has an opportunity to not do that with, you know, turning into a werewolf. Like, he has an ability that lets him step outside himself, and he can actually affect change in a pretty dramatic way.
Yeah, fantastical stories are often have metaphorical, you know, aspects to them, too.
Or aspirational.
Sure.
Yeah.
That works too. Well, let's talk about Skinned a little bit and your collaboration with Tim Daniel. How did that come about?
Tim and I have known each other for a while. We met at the first Image Expo. So one of my closest friends in comics is Curtis Weeb, and he introduced me to Tim. Tim was working at the Image Shadowline booth, and I had a couple pitches that I was still working on, and I had some images on my phone, and I showed Tim, you know, the cover to Cobble Hill and the cover to Southern Dog, and he was really blown away by it, and he was just like, "You got to send this to me. I'm gonna do some logos for you, and we'll just work something out." I was like, "Okay," and that's just how our friendship started. And he's done the design work for just about everything I've produced in the last 3 years, and he's also an idea machine. So he came to me with like 3 or 4 ideas. He's like, "I've got these pitches I want to get off the ground, but I really love, like, I love what you're doing with these, your books, and I want to bring you in on one of the projects." I was like, "Okay." So he gave me a couple ideas, and we started working on 2 of them, and Skinned kind of really took off, and we were really excited about it. And we'd been working on it for maybe a year before we were able to get it in at Monkey Brain. So, but yeah.
So has the process on that book been different than some of the other, you know, the projects we've talked about?
Yeah, it's been different because, you know, every writer has their own process, and, you know, how they outline, how they script, how they edit. You know, there's no format. Like, there's no specific format that every writer has to use. Like, you know, with screenplays, you got to use, you know,
right,
you know, final draft, and it has to look the same. And but working with Tim actually was really great because it got me out of being so possessive over my process. Like, I was very open to, you know, saying, "Oh, let me see some of your outlines and see how you do it, and I'll show you some of mine." And we kind of built one together that was kind of a marriage of both our styles. And then once we kind of figured that out, the process went a lot easier. So I would draft an outline, Tim would review it, he'd, you know, throw in stuff, edit things, and we discuss it and hammer it out and make it as how we like it. And then I would start scripting it. So I actually have done the majority of the scripting, but he's gone in and he's, you know, he's been living with this project for much longer than I have. So he knows the characters a lot better than I do. So he kind of I'd say edits it, and he was actually the one who was really specific with all the skin flips, which I kind of left that entirely up to him because it was really something that he had thought of, and I thought he'd have a better grasp on, you know, what skins work best for what scenes. But it's a really good process, and we were able to churn out quite a few scripts pretty early on. So,
how much of that is, I guess not how much, but more so, how is that communicated in terms of the art? Because it's such a unique concept right off the bat that you have to communicate primarily visually. That what is happening is that we're seeing the skin from the perspective of the various characters. And so how do you communicate that with your artist?
I mean, the scripts are pretty tight. Like, they're very detailed. I mean, very succinctly detailed. So they're not super long or anything, but, the script would read like any comic book script an artist would get, but at the end of each panel description, there is kind of in brackets a skin reference. And just something for the artist to keep in mind when he started to lay out the pages.
Sure. I mean, it's almost like the style changes for, right? You're switching from, I just think that that's a sort of a fun set of options that you're giving.
Right? Yeah.
For each.
I mean, Josh, it's impressive because there was never one moment where he was like, you know, I can't or I won't draw that. Like, he just did it, and he did it better than I think Tim and I could have imagined. And what's interesting about that book is, you know, when art pages would roll in, for me, something that I like is I know I've done a good job scripting when I can look at a unlettered page and know exactly what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
With skin, that is very difficult. Because
I can imagine.
I was quite nervous, honestly. I remember, you know, thinking to myself when I first saw the early pages in the first issue, I was like, this is not going to work. Like, no one is going to know what's going on. But, you know, the lettering is a really good anchor for all of that. And, you know, I have to give credit to Matt Milikoff for his lettering. And, you know, I was really kind of surprised with the response that the first issue got. Even just leading up to the first issue, there was a huge response. I mean, the biggest response I've ever had on any book I've worked on.
When the cover dropped, I think is when everybody went a little nuts, because it was like the cover is very striking. But then hearing the description with the cover of this, I don't know. Science fiction is super hot right now, and it's a story that borrows heavily from that world, but presented in a way that is, you know, new and fun, and that's what people are looking for. So, not surprised that people went nuts over it, I guess is what I'm saying. let's talk a little bit about school, because I know that you went to a conservatory to be a sound designer, and I know that you talk so much about how, like, that has nothing to do with what you're doing now, and it has nothing to do with comics, but I actually think it does. I think that design is inherently collaborative, and so are comics. And I guess I'm wondering if you've considered how that helps you approach storytelling from a different perspective, like from a more holistic way, thinking about how all of the pieces come together.
That's a very insightful question. Yeah, I think I have thought about it on some level. Maybe not so much with my degree specifically, but with the experience of going through art school and with the experience of fixing a computer. I think that, you know, fixing a computer for me has opened my eyes to how I work as a writer, because I'm very analytical. I like building a structure for myself and following through and executing that and moving on to the next thing. And sound design is really not that different. Like, and it's really understanding how something works. Like, understanding how a film gets made from a sound design standpoint is really kind of interesting, because, you know, doing location recordings and doing, you know, ADR and Foley recordings in a sound booth, you realize that there are lots and lots of layers to a film. Mm-hmm. And a sound designer's job is if you can't detect that they've done anything, then they've done a great job.
Right.
So you won't hear the rustling of a lavalier microphone, or, you know, that sound effect will sound exactly perfect, or the ADR recording synced up perfectly. I think all of that kind of is the theme of understanding how something works. And that's kind of what I spent the first few years with comics, was understanding how comics get made, understanding how they get written. There are a lot of writers that do post their scripts online, which for me was extremely helpful. I think I liked Jason Aaron and Joshua Dysart's formats the most, and I kind of created my own format out of both of theirs, and that really actually sped up my process, and I was able to script and more specifically edit much faster. So it's been, you know, continuing education, but, you know, I think that even though I don't use my degree, I don't regret going to art school. Sometimes I regret my student loans, but I mean, overall, like, if I didn't do those things, I would never have moved to New York. If I'd never moved to New York, none of this would have happened. Right. So
do we see any of your thoughts about art school specifically in Art Monster? Is that a totally loaded question or
what? You see a lot of it. I don't even hide some of it. Like,
the opening in the second issue about wanting to find something that is like a medium that comes naturally is, just awesome. It's just fucking fantastic because it is a very clear articulation of every artist's desire for the work to be less work itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's really the idea of finding a medium of art that feels more like a reflex than a conscious decision has been kind of my mantra for the last 5 or so years.
God, I love it. I love it so much.
And Art Monster, there are a lot of things, like, you know, the way that the college president is portrayed is honestly my own opinion on how the president of my art school operated. And some of the characters, pieces of them are people I met along the way in art school, and just the vibe in general, how everybody's kind of, you know, there is an independence to everybody, but everybody's, you know, kind of learning from each other because it's all very creative. And and it's, when you have all of these options, when you go to an art school, you have all these options. And especially when everybody goes in more or less undeclared, you kind of wonder, could I do any of it? Could I do all of it? And, you know, I saw some students that, you know, they had declared that they were illustration majors and they were just terrible at drawing. And professors would just say it like, what's your major? Illustration. No, it shouldn't be.
Right.
And yeah, so it's like, you know, I was kind of in the middle of the road. Like, I could draw, I could do the lecture classes and the art history classes just fine. I could take a test just fine. So there was nothing that stood out to me. And I liked drawing, but I didn't like it enough to fill a sketchbook. And that kind of goes back to me liking to do something once and moving on to the next thing. And I remember I had a professor in my Life Drawing 2 class who, the first thing he says to everybody on the first day is, I do not give an A to anybody. Like, you have to work for that A. And if you get it, then you've done a really good job. So it's like, okay. And he was the one who would just make people cry. He's like, what is this? This is not art. This is terrible. And he sat me down at the end of the semester, and he was like, what is your major? I said, oh, I'm a film major. He said, no, that's going to be a hobby. You need to take my other drawing classes. You need to do illustration. I was like, yeah, no, I just, it's not something that I get up and I want to do. And so I kind of forced myself into the film sound design degree, and I got too far into it to turn around. And I was like, well, I'm not going to stay here for 2 more years to figure it out. I'm just going to get the degree and move on with my life. And so finding comics was a really happy accident, and it was kind of like winning the lottery. It was like that big question of what am I going to do with my life was kind of answered, and I didn't have to stress about it. I was like, I know what I need to do, and that's it. Like, knowing is half the battle. And then just actually working at it and learning to be better, and having, you know, what I learned most in art school is being able to take criticism. I think that was the biggest tool early on, because I got a lot of rejections, but because I showed enough humility and I showed enough, you know, aptitude to apply the notes I got from editors editors remembered me, and they were, you know, really surprised, and they were like, you know, you're getting further along than most people because you clearly are listening.
Right, because you're taking the criticism, but you're also applying the constructive suggestion. My guess is that you also gained an appreciation for how to present your work or to articulate a pitch also.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
That seems like that would be worth it almost in that case, because getting over the hurdle, and I see this so much with creators, is getting over that hurdle of rejection and the learning to not take it personally and not take it as a defeat. Like that's a life lesson that's worth thousands, I think, for everyone.
Oh man, I don't think everybody who goes to art school will learn that lesson.
Well, I don't think most people learn that lesson. It's just not in our nature. You know, we take it too seriously. It's crushing, especially if it's something you've created.
Right.
You know, then it's like you've poured your heart and soul into something. How is somebody going to tell you it's not the beautiful masterpiece that you envision it in your brain, you know?
Right.
And then how do you then get over that next hurdle of, okay, I can make this better, or I can learn from this and go on. Like that in terms of art, God, that's like that rare, you know, that's that rare skill that if they should just make it a class in any kind of creative school where somebody just yells at you and tells you, it's like drill sergeants in a way.
Yeah. I had that class. I had more than one of that class in art school. So I still think, though, that there is something about the process of learning how to accept that and apply it in a constructive way that can't be taught. You either get it or you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think initially getting rejection was not hard. I think as I've gotten further into all of this, I think the rejections have gotten harder, because like I feel like I do have a pretty solid grasp on how to put together a pitch, how to write a comic book, how to make edits, how to do all of it. And so when I do get those rejections now, it's just like, oh, what am I missing? Like,
That makes sense.
And I think now the biggest thing is just timing. I think specifically with most of 2013 and most of this year, the rejection I've gotten from publishers is because of timing. They're like, oh, we really like this story, but we've already got two similar ones in the works. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, being able to take criticism is huge. And
perspective.
I met a guy at a convention at WonderCon, like maybe 4 years ago. And I decided to sign up for this, speed dating for artists and writers. And it was like WonderCon's first time doing it, where you go into a room and there's writers and artists, and you have like 5 minutes to sit with one, and then you discuss your project, and then you move to the next one, and hopefully you can, you know, build a friendship and a working relationship. So I go, and there's, I don't know, 40, 45 writers, and there's 5 artists. And it's like really awkward. It's like, oh my God, who's going to make the first move? This is like, who's going to go on the dance floor first?
Right.
And I was in line and just talking to some people online, and I had printed one of my comics. I had finished the first issue and I printed it out, and I was going to hand it around to editors as a pitch. And I printed it like a comic, so it looked like something you could buy off the shelf. And a bunch of people were like, where'd you buy that? I was like, oh, no, this is mine. They're like, oh, well, can I buy it from you? So, yeah. So I was selling my book in line for this thing, and this guy starts talking to me about his book, and he's like, oh, I've got this book, and he printed it out, and it was like this the shape of a TV remote, so it was like a rectangular book. And I was like, okay, what's it about? He's like, it's about Christmas. I was like, okay, what else? He's like, well, it's Christmas every day. Okay, where's the drama? What's going on? He's like, no, that's it. And he's like, and it's a silent comic book.
Oh.
It's like, okay, well, it's an odd shaped book. Do you know who you might pitch this to? I mean, the only publisher I know that does kind of odd shaped books and prints them real nice is Arkea. Have you thought about going to their booth? And it's like, no, I don't know who that is. So I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, giving him some advice. And he went and he actually talked to the assistant editor that I had gotten to know a few months earlier, and he comes back and he was really upset. He was like, I went to talk to this assistant editor who I think she was a glorified intern because she hated my book. He was like, oh. And he's like, but you know, it's Christmas every day of the year. How can that not be liked? I was
like, yeah, he has a point.
I mean,
everybody loves Christmas.
That's true.
But you know, I don't know. And
have you lived a full year of Christmas? You can't say you don't like it until you have.
It was just one of those moments where I was just like, I can't help you because you're not helping yourself.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting meeting people, and it surprises me that people can't be open to that.
Maybe maybe that's the danger in the creative process, is you can never think your book is perfect.
You can't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. I mean, if I thought any of the books I've done were perfect or I was the best at it, then I should just quit and move on to something else. Like, why would I want to be the best at something? I want to be great. I want the respect of my peers, but I want to keep creating. I want my next book to be more exciting than my previous one.
Once you win at comics, then you quit and move on to the next thing.
Well, let's talk about something fun. Let's talk about comics. And what are you reading at the moment? Like, are there any you're behind on that you feel you need to pull together to get caught up before like the summer and fall events start? Or like what's really, I don't know, what's eating up your time, reading time right now?
I guess I've been reading a lot. I've recently transitioned into digital comics. Like, so I lived in New York City for about a little over 5 years, and I recently relocated to Vermont, and there are no comic book shops in my town. So I got an iPad and I was like, oh, okay, bah humbug, I'm going to do this digital thing. And it's been really convenient, not going to lie, except with the recent change in the app, which is kind of annoying. But I guess the books that I'm reading now, I'm loving Southern Bastards, by the Jasons.
Do you connect on a lot of levels with that one?
I do. And the thing is like, when I read the first issue, I was like, oh my God, am I going to do the South justice? Like, these guys lived and breathed it their entire lives. Like, I'm just telling it from a very small perspective from my own view. And I was like, man, I hope mine doesn't come off as just cartoonish. But
much different story.
It is. It is. I think there are some things I just read the second issue today, and I was reading some of the dialogue, and I was like, you know, that's actually how I would have wrote that line. I was like, oh, that gives me some confidence. Other than that, I don't know. There's just a handful of comics I've been kind of keeping up with. Bob Fingerman's Minimum Wage, I love.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually gotten to know Bob over the last few years, and it's been really cool to see that book come back.
That's a very, very personal story.
Yeah, yeah. And it's it gives me that kind of nostalgia of New York, honestly, which is what I love most about it. Can you
ever leave New York once you've lived there for a while?
Like, you?
Even though you physically are away, do you always pine for it?
I pine for it when my fiance leaves for business trips for a while. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a routine now, and like, you know, it works for me. And like, I'm not going to lie, quality of life in Vermont has gone up. When you live in New York City, or any major city for that matter, there's a level of stress you just deal with, and you acclimate to it, and that's just how life is. Like, life is a roller coaster up and down every month. When you move to Vermont, that goes away completely. But most of the friends we have in town are her colleagues, and Vermont's not the type of place where you just call up a friend and be like, hey, let's go get a drink. It's, oh, what are you doing on the 13th of next month?
Uh-huh.
Which is weird, but, you know, that's just how everyone operates, because everyone's, you know, pretty busy. And she was on a 2-week trip in China for work. And, you know, being here by myself, it's like, I've been telling this to a couple people. Like, I was at the, she left, and it was like 2 days after she'd left. And I went to the grocery store to get some stuff, and I was leaving. And I suddenly had this moment where I was like, I feel like I'm in witness protection. I'm living this quiet suburban life. No one knows I'm here. Like, this is weird. So, you know, trying to acclimate to a routine without her, you know, took a couple days. But you know, leaving New York, it's like, I love going back, and I think I could definitely move back if I had the chance. I don't think that's going to happen, but, yeah, I mean, there's a part of me that, you know, I before I met my fiance, I was pretty set on living and dying in Brooklyn. I was like, I'm just going to live here the rest of my life. Like, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, a part of me always wants to go back.
Well, so with all this free time in the suburbs, do you watch a lot of television? Do you read a lot? What do you do then? Or what do you want to share with us that you have read or seen recently that you think other people should be paying more attention to? Not just comics.
Yeah, a lot of TV. I think that True Detective took up a lot of my time.
Oh, yes.
Sure, yeah.
It's kind of become my goal to work that into every episode in some capacity. So, well done. Now I don't have to bring it up when we record the rest of the show on Wednesday.
Awesome. Awesome. I honestly, I think about that show every day.
Yeah. Oh my God, me too.
At some point I think about it, and the last episode was so emotional for me that I was beside myself. I didn't really like either character going into the show. I was like, I can barely stomach them. Like, they're both odd, amoral. Like, I can't really align with them. And by the end of it, like, you know, obviously if anyone's listening to this who hasn't seen the show, I'm sorry, but like seeing them almost die, like my heart broke. I was like, these guys have gone through so much, and they're at their end. They are at literally their end, and they're fighting to keep each other alive. And I was just like, I couldn't take it. I was like, this is, I've never seen anything like this, and it's haunting. And I think about it a lot. So that show has taken up a lot of time, even though it's the season's over.
I rewatched it.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Cause let's see, when we first started watching it, I watched like the first two episodes, and then I didn't watch for a while. And so then rewatched the first two, and then up through like the fifth one, and then waited and watched, 6, 7, and 8, like as they were released. And so, when it was completed, I felt like the resolution wasn't quite as fulfilling. Like, I wanted more immediately. And so I've been slowly rewatching, and I've seen all of them now twice. And it was really useful for me to go back to catch some of the visual information, having already understood where the story was going to take me.
Sure.
And to just appreciate how fucking stunning the entire shoot is, like from the beginning to the end, everything is so meticulously planned and is so incredible to watch. So yeah, I highly recommend, in your copious free time, watching it again.
I can do that. That show is been up there for me. House of Cards, I got into.
Sure.
And I binged on that. But I mean, mostly any of the Netflix originals I've basically watched. But as far as reading, I'm trying to think. I haven't. The thing with driving to work every day now, rather than taking the subway, is that it's killed my reading time.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't read as much now. I have all these books, and I look at some of the books on my shelf, and I'm like, wow, did I read all? Yeah, I really did read all of these. When did I read all of these? Like, I don't even remember now.
Well, man, but time is a flat circle.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good point.
It's like your trump card at this point.
It really fits basically like every discussion.
Everything.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't go wrong with it. Yep. It's the modern day, all right, all right.
Yeah.
Well, here's your chance to leave us with, one last tidbit of wisdom, you know, something that'll change the world or the minds of everyone who listens.
Like, what is your time as a flat circle? Oh, you sort of gave it to us already. You gave us your mantra.
Yeah, the
Searching for a medium that isn't.
Yeah, so that's more of a reflex.
That's more of a reflex. Man, I love that. Really, I really do.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I told that to a good friend of mine once, and he had the same reaction. He's like, "Wow." I'm like, "What?" He's like, "That's good." I was like, "Well, I mean, it's just how I feel. Like, I really, you know, getting up and writing comics is not something I go, oh God, I got to do this today. Like, everything I've attempted as a career has elicited that response. Like, oh, I got to do this today." Right. And when I started writing comics, you know, working out stories in my head was analytical, and it was structure, and it was organizing things. And I spent a lot of time organizing thoughts, and it just clicked. Like, organizing thoughts, organizing plot, characters, seeing story arcs play out, and, you know, seeing how other people play with those things has also been really informative. You know, like Curtis Weeb, I love his books, and especially Greenwake. Greenwake was a book that I adored when it came out, and I grabbed every single issue when it came out. And that was one of the first times I read a book that felt extremely personal. And knowing Curtis, you know, I know where he drew some of those inspirations from. And, you know, I want to do that more. I want to explore the stories I'm excited about, and I want other people to be excited about them. So.
Yeah. Being excited about what you do is something I think anybody who isn't excited gets kind of envious about. That search for things to feel natural and things to feel like more of a reflex and not of a struggle, I think, is applicable outside of the arts. But I absolutely love it as a little personal mantra. I intend to share that with as many people now as I possibly can. So
please do.
Well, thank you, Jeremy, for joining with us today on the couch. It's been a really great conversation. Thanks. And thank you to everybody for listening to yet another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally, especially in the case of Jeremy's two books from Monkey Brain Comics, which are available digitally through Comixology. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. Thank you.
What am I gonna do when the aliens get here? Austin is powered up enough to fill that landscape. 2.7 in the cockpit, chemicals rides from Saturn across. From the Mercury astronaut, George Austin. From the economics liberation in Boston. Massachusetts protected by the Army and Red Berets. Special effect units, navigational training. 4 altitudes, 3 compulsive rates. Phoenix, Arizona, Yelona. Aliens looking in my face, reserve Marines. Coming in, coming in. Coming in, coming in.